We can go as much into the data that we want, or we can go off topic as much as we want. So leave it to anybody that wants to. Feel free today, certainly, to throw whatever question you want in, and it doesn't have to be on topic if you so desire. Also, this is not formally your last one, is it? Might be.
Yeah,
okay,
might
since be. It might be Carl's last one, and I wish we had more people here to make this note. Carl is very, very, very probably moving to California here in the near future, along with his family. They boo. That's the bad news. The good news is it means Solid Ground West Coast is going to kick off. So Solid Ground 2.0, the much improved version of it, will be starting at a local church there. Dennis wishes to comment on this one tonight.
I think you should mention that Carl is going back into active service.
Yes, that's right. He is going to be. He's always been a Marine officer of high skill, and now they're doing the, okay, we're going to put you, they're recognizing for what he is a great mind, and they're going to plug all of these cables into his brain like something out of the Matrix, and now he has to plan a whole bunch of stuff. Thanks a bunch, Carl. I mean, why don't you say, make some remarks if you wish on.
The only thing I'd like to say is it's been a huge blessing for me and my family to be here at Solid Ground. It's really prepared my kids in a way that I was not prepared. So I grew up in a Christian home. My dad was a Lutheran pastor. I was in Bible study. I did a lot of things coming up through grade school and high school that I assumed would get me ready for college, and it really didn't. When I went to college, I was blown away by the onslaught of agnosticism, of atheism, and really had a serious crisis of faith because I just wasn't ready for the arguments that were going to be made in that secular environment. And as many of you know, my daughter Mason, she just finished up her freshman year at the University of Alabama, and rather than having a crisis of faith as she went into that same environment, very similar environment, the University of Alabama. She's really grown in her faith, is totally grounded, found a great church family there, and really has been able to engage with her atheist and agnostic friends. She's majoring in physics and electrical engineering, so the vast majority of her friends fall into that category. And again, I think it's because of what Solid Ground is doing, she's been equipped to go out and do those things. And you know, my son Rowan now, he just graduated high school. He's off. He's going to be doing, it looks like, a fellowship in the human rights area. And again, looking for opportunities to dialogue with people about how we do human rights and bringing a Christian perspective to that. And so Magnus here is going to be headed with me to California to finish off high school. But again, I just really think that what we're doing here at Solid Ground is providing the tools that young people need to go and have meaningful dialogue with atheists and agnostics and to realize they have good reason to have the faith that they do. So again, thank you, Scott, for what you've done, and thank you, everyone, for the support you've been to our family. Really appreciate it, and we'll stay in touch from the West Coast for sure.
Sounds good. Yeah, we'll stay as tied in as we possibly can. But God's best of luck and Godspeed to you. Okay, what we'll do is we'll start where we left off last time, but you can interject from second one onto whenever you want with anything that you wish to. So last time we had talked about, we were setting the stage for two things. One, all the philosophical arguments that are out there, in my opinion, ultimately kind of begin, or we had talked about properly basic beliefs and axioms and all this stuff, that most foundational level, this is at the most foundational level, this idea of necessity and contingency. This is as foundational as it gets, about as foundational as it gets in philosophy. Some things we had said were, the reason for this being important is all the other arguments that are out there are about knowledge that we build on top of these foundations. So in reality, I kind of think, and I'm in the minority on this one, but I think that there are several arguments that we break out, arguments for God as an example, arguments for other things, that in reality reduce down to a single argument. So depending on what you believe about time or about causality, depending on how fundamental you think that goes, different arguments like a fine-tuning argument, a cosmological argument, and a contingency argument may all actually reduce down to the same argument or something like that. So if it's going to reduce to something, it's always going to reduce. Many of these arguments that we're going to talk about later are going to be answered by what your beliefs are about necessity and contingency. in my opinion. Because whilst the arguments work deductively at their own level, if you want to challenge the premises, you have to challenge them more at a deeper level than they make themselves, and this is part of that deeper level. Okay, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about here, at least with the Leibnizian argument. So you'll remember necessity were things that have to exist. It's impossible that they not exist. There is no world that could happen or nothing that could happen and they not exist. Even if there was no universe at all, you don't need the number 7 to be caused. If you believe that numbers are real things, that they exist, the fact that the universe exists, comes into being or exists at all, even if it doesn't come into being, if it's eternal or if it never existed, the number 7 will always be 7. The numbers 3 and the numbers 4 will always add up to 7. It doesn't matter what your universe is. So those kind of truths, necessary truths, like 1 plus 1 equals 2 or 2 plus 2 equals 4, those are necessary truths, and they don't need causes. They exist because of the necessity of their own nature. Okay.
So do you believe that those truths actually have independent existence?
Let me suspend the answer to that question for now for the purpose of this and argue that one in a bit. So we said there are a few classes of possible of things that can be necessary things. Mathematical truths, logical truths, definitions of a certain type. We put God in that category as at least the concept of a being that has to exist. It's impossible that his existence not be. And this would be if you think God is something like a maximally great being. So that's another possibility of something that might be a necessary being. So there's all the things that might be necessary, something like God, numbers, abstract objects. And then there are contingent things. Contingent things are anything that didn't have to be or didn't have to be the way that it is. So didn't have to be, cows. You can imagine this world easily without cows. In an evolutionary environment, it might be that cows never came to exist because this gene didn't do that at this time. In a creation, young Earth creation model, God might not have made cows. This just all appeared out of nothing, or it's always been here forever. It may have been the case that this thing that's always been here forever has cows or doesn't have cows. So cows are contingent. So this universe is the same way as what we said last time. I'm not familiar with anybody, not that I know the literature terribly well, but I'm not familiar with any contemporary philosopher on any side of any line that argues that this universe is necessary. Because it's so easy to say, well, it seems very possible that this universe didn't exist. So it could be that this universe didn't exist, or if it did exist, it didn't have to be the way that it is. It's not necessarily this way. You could have had eggs for breakfast instead of cereal. That seems to be a real possibility. So since that's the case on possibility, contingency, then the universe would be contingent. Now, if you take those two definitions, like I laid them out, and that's the way that you think of necessity and contingency, which is the bog standard set of definitions, then this is Leibniz's argument. He says, everything that exists, this is a version of it, everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. So everything that is has an explanation of why it's there, either in the necessity of its own nature, like God or abstract objects or whatever else, or in some external cause, i.e., you exist because your parents or something like that. Okay? That is usually pretty uncontroversial. However, you can try to attack it. The second premise seems way out there. I'll say it. Like when you first look at it, you say to yourself, where are you getting this premise? So the next premise says, if the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. That kind of seems like, doesn't that seem a little strange to you? Doesn't seem like you're jumping out of nowhere with that one? I think so. The reason that premise is less controversial than you would think isn't because it's intuitively obvious by the statement, that the statement's just clearly true. It's that the number one objection to this one historically is the same statement as this, just said differently, and I'll tell you what I mean here. Normally, and I'm not saying all atheists say this, but when an atheist in general, in the past, has objected to premise 2, the objection has said something like this. This is what they'll say. If the universe, let me back up. I'll state it the other way around, it'll be easier. If God does not exist, which is the assumption of atheism, then the universe has no cause. Or no explanation, I should say. Has no explanation. So this has been the traditional objection. This has been the traditional position of the atheist. I'm not saying that all atheists believe this. I'm saying this has been the traditional number one belief about this. Now, what I'll point out is when you negate something, you can say something like, this is not an insignificant result to some scientific study. This was not an insignificant result. That really just means it is a significant result. Those statements are logically equivalent. This is a significant result. This is not an insignificant result. Same thing. If God does not exist and the universe has no explanation, is in fact logically equivalent to if the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. Do you see what I'm saying? If God does not exist, so here's P, then the universe has no explanation, that's Q. So if P, then Q. That's what the statement is here, logically speaking. If P, then Q.
And given that both of these actually have a negative in them, right, the easier translation would be to make those a not P and a not Q.
Right. So there you go. So if not P, then not Q. And what we're saying is, if P then Q, or ultimately Q implies in this case P. So if you turn around and if P happens, if you deny, it's called denying the consequent. You can deny the antecedent, you can deny the consequent. But in this case, basically, you can see that if you take the negations away, they're equivalent. And that is to say, if God does exist, then that's the explanation for the universe. So you just pull the knot out of each one of them is what Carl's pointing out. So that this is not a necessary truth right here, but the point is the normal objection is equivalent to this one. So the bottom line is the atheist ought not object to this premise. That is to say, if the universe has an explanation, then that explanation is God, because that's logically equivalent to what he normally or she normally says anyway. So really now what you're back to denying is premise one, if you want to deny the conclusion of this argument, which is the universe has an explanation because it's contingent. It's not necessary. The universe has an explanation. Therefore, the explanation of the universe is God.
In Q, are you saying that if God does, are you saying that an atheist might say if God does not exist, the universe has no cause? Or just doesn't have an explanation.
And in this case, they would be the same. So if you're going to say an explanation, the explanation could be one of two things. The explanation could be an external cause, or it could be that the universe is necessary. So the reason I don't use the word cause there is because there is another possibility, the necessity of its own nature, right here, this part, that's one option for why the universe exists. But nobody says that option's any good in the case of the universe. So that leaves you this one.
Must have a cause.
Yeah.
And so here God is just something, some being, some...
So a particular being that he's necessary.
That's necessary and has a causal relationship.
Right. Now you say, well, how did you get to God of all necessary things, how is God the one that happens to be the cause of it? The answer is nobody yet has thought of, maybe there is, but of all necessary things that exist, all of them except for God are abstract objects. And abstract objects can't cause anything. That's in the definition of what it is to be an abstract object. That is to say, the truth, 2 + 2 = 4, doesn't cause anything to come into existence. Something like God can cause something to come into existence, at least by our concept of what that God would be. Dennis.
I have a problem with the first thing you said. You said that number 7, even if there's no universe, exists. Well, if there's absolutely, I'm not sure what nothing is, where anybody's ever tried to really explain that, but if there's absolutely nothing, how can we be the number seven?
So I'm actually, the reason I deferred that question was just so that I could get through this explanation with the maximum clarity. Now I'll answer the question because I'm totally on your side on this one. In fact, you're sitting next to your chief opponent, though, because Carl's not on your side on this one. So let me throw this grenade in onto your
Carl's
table.
Carl's not my chief opponent. His daughter, Mason, is.
Yeah, well, she's pretty clever, isn't she? I don't. So the question is basically: Do abstract objects really exist? I'm not sure what nothing is. Somebody has to. Aristotle took a stab at answering that. Aristotle's definition of nothing was what rocks dream about. What rocks dream about. So the idea is the of nothing is the absence of existence. So maybe you could say. If I said there was nothing on this table, what I was implying is there exists no thing on this table. It means that there's no thing that exists there.
Well, if it means that, then there's no center. Because that's something.
So Plato is probably, I think, feel free to disagree, especially those that hold the position. I think that this really starts with the Greeks and starts with Plato, where he sees these truths that are out there, and he's trying to explain why it's the case. Why is it the case that geometers are saying, look, all these circles have the same formula that defines them all? All triangles, their angles are always add up to the same number. When you set them in certain relationships, they always... So how is it that this math seems to fit our world so well? They were starting to answer that question, or try to answer that question. And the answer, basically, for Plato turned out to be this. He uses the example of the cave. He says, you imagine a bunch of guys, I'm going to change the story a little bit just so it's simpler. You imagine a bunch of guys that are sitting there and there's a fire behind them and they see their own shadows on the wall of the cave. They see shadows on the wall of the cave. You see shadows on the wall of the cave. There's a reality there that you can't see. You're only seeing the shadows. But there's a more real reality that is the source of that projection in the fire and the people. So he thinks that this world, the reason that the world's a little bit fuzzy, but there seem to be these things that the rule sticks no matter where you apply it, is because there exists an actual higher ideal world. And cosmology started to follow that. This is the reason that guys from the medieval ages who believed very much in Aristotelian and Platonic thought, this is the reason that they wanted the Earth to be a perfect circle. They want the universe, the planets travel in perfect circles. Because they are better at following the higher ideal than we are, and because they're higher things, they must be traveling in perfect circles. And so the eventual model, the Ptolemaic model, comes up of these crystal spheres that rotate. Crystal is kind of a perfect substance. All this idea of perfection is driving the Greeks' model and Plato's model. And so he thinks there's an actual real world that exists somewhere that has all these ideals, and you'll find it today in a book by...
What's the guy? Tegmark's
book is... who's the guy that wrote the fiction book that's 800 pages long about fantasizing that the universities are the highest form of...
Oh, you're talking about Neal Stephenson's book?
Yeah, Neal Stephenson wrote a book called Anathem.
His boat sank.
Yeah, which where in that book, they believe in it's kind of an alternate universe that is one of many universes that spawn off from this one, but it's basically the way a Platonist would do physics.
It's like Back to the Future too.
It's on acid. So when you look at this idea of there, he says there's a highest world, and all the worlds that we live in are derivative of that one. And if you're kind of enlightened, you can hop between these worlds and live forever and all this nonsense.
Hey, earlier you said that it's an absolute truth that in geometry all angles of a triangle add up to 360.
No, 180. Yeah. With some specifications. On a Euclidean surface, all triangles.
But in non-Euclidean geometry, they don't.
Right.
And parallel lines meet in some non-Euclidean geometry.
Yes, that's right.
So, where's the absolute truth of that?
So, I'm on your side. I don't think that... I think that every number has to have a referent. So, in the same way that you used to get in trouble maybe in math or in science, for not labeling your axes, for not labeling, if you did a calculation and it was something meters per second over seconds, and then they cancel and remember all that kind of stuff. So you have to do the labeling in there. So I believe that numbers absent labels are not real. Carl disagrees, so he can give you his take here in a second. But I believe that they're not real because if you don't label things, if I ask you what's 1 plus 1, your answer is? It's not a trick question. Well, it is a trick question. 1 plus 1 is 2. Let me ask you this. I've got one drop of water on the table, and I'm going to add another drop of water to it. How many drops of water do I have now?
One,
because it's just a bigger drop of water. Now, if you turn around and say, well, you've missed the point, Scott. What you really added was 1 cubic centimeter of water to 1 cubic centimeter of water, in which case you ended up with 2 cubic centimeters of water, and that's what you're really adding. And I said, but do you see my point? The labels matter. The point is the labels matter. So this is you have to do more than that. That's not enough to make the argument. But this points you in the direction of what I think the answer is, which is, I tend to agree with you, Dennis. I don't think that such abstract objects exist. I think they are mental objects. I think they are useful fictions that match the reality of the real world, maybe for one of two reasons. I'll leave Carl's explication to what those might be, but I do agree with you on that one. However, there's a Neoplatonist right next to you that can tell you differently.
I mean, yeah, so I guess my conception of number is number is, again, not, maybe I'm not a, I guess Neoplatonist is probably the best way to put it. So I don't think that 7 exists independently of itself. But, you know, when we talk about basic mathematical truths, 1 plus 1 equals 2, right, that's a necessary truth. And all these numerical concepts that we have in the abstract are numerical truths that exist independently of us as human beings. Whether they can exist independently of God, that I doubt. Right, that's where it gets tricky. But that would be my description of it. And I think you always have to be aware of units, like Scott says. But I think we have a lot of other more basic truths. The law of non-contradiction, right? I think that's a necessary truth that is going to be true in all possible worlds. So I would say that concept, while it may be, the concept exists, right? It's not a physical object, but it's something that really does exist, independent of our minds, at least.
But if there's absolutely nothing in the universe, how can even the law of non-contradiction exist?
Because you still have, in my conception, God, even if there's no universe, God still exists. Yeah. So you have a concept of existence or non-existence right there.
So you're assuming the existence of God.
Yes, in this situation, absolutely.
No, you're not assuming the existence of God. You're assuming that there is something other than the universe that can't exist.
Now, that's true. Yeah, you're right. That's true.
Now, in the panoply of things that we can think of, things like numbers and all that kind of laws of logic, that kind of thing, if those things don't, the question is, on what basis do they exist? Do they exist in their own right? Do they exist even if nobody thinks them? Are they may be, you may say they're true if nobody thinks them, but do they exist if nobody thinks them? There's an easy answer for the Platonist, the Neoplatonist, which is, it's not a Neoplatonic position to say they exist because they're God's way of thinking. Some people will ground it and say, the reason that happens is because that's how God thinks, or that's the way that he thinks. That's not the Neoplatonist position, though. The Neoplatonist says this, here's reality divided into two circles, here's stuff that's necessary, here's stuff that's contingent, here's stuff and things, and over here is God and numbers. So while you might say, you know, if numbers exist because they're necessary truths and God exists because he's a necessary being, then it's not that numbers exist because of God. They exist because of another reason. So they exist along with God. That's what a Platonic position, that is what some Neoplatonists say. I take that to be the Neoplatonic position. Yes, sir?
Me or Chris?
You first and then Chris.
Okay. All right. Number 7, number 2, as we look at this symbol, that's all it is. This is a symbol. Somehow there was a realization that had come to, in other words, a 7 did not drop down from the sky. Unless you think of maybe Hebrew or Greek, where the letters actually represent those numbers. But when you really start getting involved with how communication and verbalization of what people see, then we need to get beyond some of this, I think, and just characterize the fact that these symbols, as we see, like the number 7, number 2, 1, whatever it might be, came from somewhere else. They were inspired somehow. So,
and think of
Fibonacci, for example. You know, I mean, there's patterns all over the place.
And
that's what you're talking about.
These are contentious even today. So if you go to, you know, these things are argued in the philosophy of science and mathematics. There's a lot of discussion about, or there are a lot of positions on this one. If you even go to a Christian philosopher's conference, there's a modern Christian philosopher named Peter Van Inwagen, who's very reasonably influential. He's a Platonist. He takes very much Carl's position on this kind of stuff. So there, it's not, well, you know, Christians have to believe this, and he's perfectly comfortable saying numbers exist alongside of God, and that in no way impacts who God is, that kind of thing. So, and he makes his arguments for it. So there are a lot, you can basically take any of the positions you want, and still be kind of quote unquote okay when it comes to Christian doctrine and thought and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so I know this has now gotten a little bit more complex, but oh, sorry, Chris.
I have a two-part question.
Yes, sir.
What have people offered as possible necessary things, beings? Like, what's the realm of
necessary beings?
Yeah.
God.
That's it?
Yeah.
No one said it. I mean, it sounds like someone said numbers might be.
Well, you said beings. So I don't
or
know.
Things,
if you want, yeah, okay. If you mean any object, concrete or abstract object. So and the problem is that the philosopher's lexicon is terrible because they always use the wrong words to evoke what you want in many ways. It's a small group. It's basically thing. Carl's really hit them. There are truths. Just lay that out there in total. Things like propositions are propositions that have to be true by definition. Things like laws, like the law of non-contradiction. Something cannot both be and not be at the same time. Or the way it's usually framed is A, not, parenthesis, A or not A. You can't have both. It can't both be the case that A is true and the case that not A is true at the same time in the same way. So if you have, maybe that's one kind. Another kind is numbers, mathematical objects, mathematical truths. And the other one is the only being, to my knowledge, has been proposed as a necessary being is God, is a God of some type. And the most, we'll get into an argument later of what that might look like, but the bottom line is just simply this, a necessarily existent being. Then you'd have to ask the question, why does that being exist necessarily? Why could that being not be contingent? And there has to be an answer to that question. In the same way, there has to be an answer to the question of why the number 7? Why does that have to answer? You know, Dennis offers an objection. The number 7, if there's nobody to think it, if there's nothing for it to count, why is it there? Carl has answered in what he thinks is, and not him, a lot of people have said, that's the answer to that objection.
Do people say like something like love?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be more, okay, so maybe Plato says the ideal world contains things like, ideas like love and justice and all that kind of stuff, that love would be love even if there was nobody to love anybody. The justice would still be justice no matter if there's anybody to love anybody. Dennis might object, I'll put words in his mouth now, to say, well, how can you even have a concept of justice if you don't have the concept of two other beings? And now you'll see where the Christian gets into this quickly of wanting to say something like the Trinity exists, because now you can ground these things. No, that was one part of your two-part question. What was the other part? Go ahead, Dennis, and then we'll do part
two. That one atheist argument you made is not the only one atheist made.
Right.
Another popular one that Hitchens and Dawkins like is that if there is a God, where did he come from?
Okay.
Right. And that's another...
you can ask the question.
If the universe had a cause, why doesn't God have to have a cause? I don't want to get into that.
You don't. Yeah, no worries. You don't have to. In fact, so this is
that's just another argument that is made.
This is the answer to that argument: is that there are two possible explanations for existence. One is necessity. The other one is an external cause. So the problem with Dawkins and Harris, Dennett doesn't make this argument because Dennett knows better. That he knows about this thing. Dawkins is a great biologist. He's not a terrific philosopher in most people's opinion. And so he doesn't know about this He didn't, you know, now he knows about it, but he didn't know about it at the time that he made his arguments. So the answer to that particular objection is some things exist in the necessity of their own nature, and some things exist because of an external cause.
So this is a subpart B to my first question.
Yes.
Does anyone argue that the universe is not necessary?
Everybody argues the universe is not necessary.
Or with your necessity and causality.
You mean, do they argue that the universe is necessary?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. Some people have tried to do so. It tends to fall apart because it seems just easy to point out that, can you give me a reason why this universe didn't have to exist? Why this universe had to exist, and if had to exist, also had to exist in the way that it is. That's the real rub there, is it seems trivially easy to say that's not the case. So the other way to, you know, like I said, the normal one, so most people who want to object to this argument recognize that fact, that it's just hard to say that you had to exist, and Lang had to exist, and I had to exist. Instead, what they have typically done is then turned around and said there just is no explanation for it. It's a brute fact. But then they run into premise two and its inverse.
So, Scott, just to lay that out, you said it was trivial, but just so I understand the argument, because we believe cows, for example, were contingent, the fact that any one aspect of this universe is contingent suggests that this universe is not necessary. Is that the argument that you're making?
What it certainly suggests is that this universe is not necessary. Now, the question might be something like this. So there is another objection, I think. Maybe this is what you all are getting to. There's another way of saying it is something like this. Well, yeah, okay, cows may be contingent, Eric may be contingent, but that principle of sufficient reason, the belief that something has to have a cause, that one goes away when you consider universes themselves. So the Earth has a reason, has to have a sufficient cause, sufficient reason for its existence, a cause for its existence, an understanding for its existence, an explanation of its existence. Let's say it has to have an explanation. The solar system has to have an explanation. The galaxy has to have an explanation. The supercluster has to have an explanation. The universe, once you get that big, doesn't. And the problem with that way of thinking is it's called, who hit this? I think Schopenhauer maybe was the guy who turned around and called this one the hack fallacy, or the not hack as in the person who makes it as a hack, but hack like a cab, but you know, the horse and carriage thing. It says you can't dismiss a principle like a taxi when you get to where you want to go. So you can't turn around and say, yeah, all these things need explanations, that's why we do science. You can't just magic your way into this stuff, you better have an explanation for it. But at the universe level, nope, you don't need that explanation anymore, we just quit. It's a brute fact. That commits what some people have called the taxi cab fallacy, going back a couple hundred years at least.
Well, even if you assume that it's a reasonable assumption that universe exists, has to have an explanation for its existence. That explanation does not have to be God.
Okay. And that's the one we just talked about here, which is this is the normal atheist position on that one. If God does not exist, then the universe has no explanation.
Science is working on that.
Okay.
And just because they
don't hold your breath.
Just because they haven't gotten there doesn't mean they won't get there.
You can get smart if you want. You can get sarcastic. But science is working on it. And if you want to say just because they haven't found the answer yet, then it must be God, it sounds an awful lot like God of the gaps argument.
Now, if the argument were the way that you characterized it, then you would be right. That would be a God of the gaps argument, which is basically something like this. There's an explanation for all this. We don't know what the explanation is, so it must be God. That's God of the gaps reasoning, and that is unfortunately all too frequently done in Christian culture today, and it's not good logic. Dennis is right, that's bad logic. Bad logic. The problem with what you're saying, Dennis, as I understand it, if I understand you correctly, is you're saying science can come to explain this at some point. Well, none of this is scientific. This is all philosophy. Science cannot inform any of this.
Well, okay. That's kind of...
Then there's a...
But what? Go ahead.
I mean, I think that just Dennis, just to your point, right? If let's say we science does develop an answer for what caused the universe, and it's not God, it's some scientific thing, it's some other feature. Then we're in infinite regress, right? Which Hawking debunks.
Well, not necessarily. Yeah, we're just assuming that.
Oh, well, I think what he's saying
is either it has its is a necessary being or was caused itself.
Yeah, that was kind of
I think you're missing a concept. You're missing a concept. You want to? So, are there scientific explanations to cause the universe to come out of nothing? There are theories that have been put forward, you know, and, you know, many worlds theories and all kinds of other, you know, chaos, different things like that. The problem is not whether you can have an explanation, a cause, to make the universe spring out of nothing. It's the intentionality that did it. Because if you have nothing, there is no force or anything to spur on the law of nature, chaos theory, or whatever, to have that to happen. So people say, well, you know, you have the many worlds theory. Okay, so now you have a multiverse. Okay, you just have the other problem. Now what caused the multiverse? Okay, then you just keep making bigger and bigger. Because the concept of nothing is so hard to understand. There is nothing there. And so, but if you had something outside of it that wasn't what we have called God, you don't have to do it. The whole point is the intentionality. Because there are, you know, math and things like that, but people could say, oh, well, that's what caused it. Okay. But what caused those things to trigger, which is the intentionality?
I sort of agree with you, but again, what is nothing?
I don't know that I agree that nothing
isn't
is...
Isn't that simple?
I don't agree that nothing is a hard concept. I think nothing is an easy concept. I think the reason that it becomes hard sometimes is we strive, in the same way that nature abhors a vacuum, we just want to stick something in where there's nothing. So if I turn around and say something to you like this, what's inside your cereal bowl? Okay, your answer is nothing. Well, then some smart aleck engineer is going to be like, technically that's not true. There's 18 air molecules of various types in here of the following ratios. Okay, well, let's evacuate it. So there's no air or anything in there. It's like space. And we say, well, there's nothing in empty space. And then someone says, well, that's not technically true. It may be the case that these quantum fluctuations that are going out there, or that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So the idea would be this. I mean, so then go to that position in space that you want to talk about and kind of tear a hole in the fabric of reality and expand it out so that there's no quantum fluctuations there. There are no quantum fluctuations. What were the things below the level of quantum fluctuation? Well, you may say space itself. Well, create a bubble in space itself, so there's space itself doesn't go into the bubble. There's nothing at all there. When we talk about nothing, it's in reference to, usually also requires a label. So if I say there are no horses in this room. What we mean is, you know, or there's zero horses in this room. There are no horses. There does not exist a horse in this room. So when you say nothing, whatever you're talking, let's say you're talking about all of reality, nothing. What you're really saying is there are no horses. There are no people. And you can go as long as you want on things that there are, and you say there are not. And that's all nothing is its non-existence.
I always like to use the example of the rainbow. There was a time when everyone thought that the rainbow was a sign of God he put up there to say no more, for whatever reason, God did it.
Right.
But we find out that that's not why it's there.
Why can it be both?
Well,
why can it be both? I mean, one, you're talking about the science of the reason the rainbow exists, and now we're talking about the philosophy of these are different things. You know, even in the scientists who proposed these theories, these maths about why something can spring from nothing, they still bring in metaphysics when they say something triggered this law to happen or this math to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's still metaphysics. And so it's...
Well, so finish your point, and I'll make a comment on that too in a second, but finish your point, Dennis. So God, the explanation for the rainbow was God did it. Now the explanation is refraction of light through water vapor in the air. What were you going to say?
Well, before, I mean, before God, before the, whatever the Bible says about it, before he put this rainbow in there, there had to have been rainbows before that in order, because he didn't even, he didn't just all of a sudden during the existence of the universe say, right, now I'm going to have light go through water droplets refract itself. At that time, after the so-called flood, they had to have existed before.
There's different explanations.
Okay, but let's say that's the case. What's the point? I'm missing the point.
That when you don't know something, when science hasn't explained it, or there's no rational explanation for it, it all comes back to God of the gaps.
Okay, in that case,
science doesn't explain everything. That's I want to make that point also. Science does not explain very much, in fact. Science is an after-the-fact assumption. That's all science is.
I'm not going to address that.
Well, I hope you told me.
So, let's leave that point off to the side for a second. Let's grant that what you're saying is correct. I mean, I'll affirm God of the gaps reasoning is bad reasoning. And if rainbows are an example of God of the gaps reasoning, then that would be bad reasoning. I'm happy to join you on that point. The point is, so the overarching point is just wait. Science is working on explaining it. Hopefully we'll get there eventually. Looking at these two premises, which I know it's a little hard to see, but looking at these two premises, which of these is science working on? What part of this do you think science is working on and might even eventually be able to answer? Can you point me to which part you're talking about?
No. Okay. Because I know nothing about philosophy or metaphysics, whatever the hell that is.
Philosophy is metaphysics is just talking about things that are not physics. That's what metaphysics is. Yeah. So ultimately, the reason I asked for the explanation, I don't mean to put you on the spot, I apologize if that's what I was doing there. To my understanding, and I think most people's understanding that think on the philosophy side, the reason that there is no that you can't say science is working on this and will get us there is that none of what is said in one or two is accessible to science at all. Science doesn't work on that one. It comes based on explanations. So one of the explanations that science starts with is that things have a cause. Like, you can't do science if you don't believe that things have a cause. Because otherwise, we could say this, let's perform an experiment. We did an experiment, accidentally. We'll perform an experiment. There are normally 30 people in this class. Let's cancel class. Let's say this, we did this last week, you weren't here. But last week I said, hey, we're not gonna hold class on the 4th of July weekend. I'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Then we said, okay, then I went and this week said on Facebook, just kidding, class is not canceled. We're gonna hold it today. And so what we did was an experiment there that said, how many people read Facebook or are in contact with people that read Facebook and also read the Solid Ground page and also would otherwise respond this way. And so now we can say, well, the cause that there are... raise your hand if you would have been here regardless of whether I had said Solid Ground is meeting. Okay? Raise your hand if you would not have been here. Okay? So you'll see that this right here, there's an explanation for that second set of hands, and the explanation is... So the experiment doesn't work if what you say is, I'm going to post to Facebook, I'm going to get two sets of people, but it could be that people showed up for none of those reasons. In fact, they showed up spontaneously and popped into existence out of nothing. Nobody lets you do that in science. You can't invoke miracle in order to do so. And miracle is this violation of these laws. Well, the violation of the laws of science, you have to have the laws of science, and the laws of science are not derived from philosophical assumptions. The laws of science are derived from an empirical process that was based on axioms that we specified. So all that to say, it seems to me that science can never inform these because these are not scientific propositions.
That's very convenient.
Do you disagree with it?
I have a question though, because
go ahead, Al.
When we were talking about this question here, and Dennis, when you said that science is working on it, it's as if science is working in this separate, like independently over here, and philosophy is working over here. And I'm always saying, no, it's science depends on philosophy. It is, you know, the most basic level, it is natural philosophy. And so to say science is working on another independently, I think that's just the wrong way of looking at it. If science answers that question, they have to do it that way. I mean, they have to.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you cannot design an experiment, or you can't put forward a hypothesis, design an experiment, do your testing, look at the results, compare it to your hypothesis, because there's just no way to test this.
So I have a problem. I have a character defect that when I am going to spend money on something, I feel like I have to get all of the options.
Right.
And it drives quick decision makers in my life crazy. So I'm trying to understand the options. Here's going to my earlier question. Is what you're saying is it something either has to, philosophically, it either is necessary, meaning it was had to exist by itself, uncaused, or it's caused.
Yes.
And so the options on the table for the universe, everything that exists, is either caused or it's necessary.
Yeah.
If it's necessary, we have to figure out why, because it feels like that's not a very compelling thought. So it seems like, all right, well, maybe it was caused, and then I was trying to figure out, well, what are the options for cause? So love could have caused it, numbers could have caused it, God could have caused it. Right. What else is there that could have caused it? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I'll give you the short answer and the long answer. The short answer to the question, at least in the way that you phrased it, is no, don't worry, all of this is free. There's no charge for the philosophy here. There's no charge. Leibniz charges us nothing on this one. So if it's, you said, if I'm going to buy something, then you don't have to pay for this one. So this is free. You don't need to worry about any of that. Okay. Now, if what you meant was you want to buy it psychologically or mentally as a truth, then this is what we're doing. We're talking about things that exist and things that do not exist. Now, we're not worried about explaining things that do not exist. We don't care. Okay, now we're going to explain things that exist. What are the possible classes of things that exist? Things that must exist and things that it's not the case that they must exist. So this one isn't there could be a third option. I'm not saying it's A or B. We're saying it's A or not A. So that's what necessity and contingency are. Is it simply when you use the word must in there, you get it either is this or it is not this. Now the question goes down to...
The must is necessary, not must is contingent.
Right. So this is also necessary and this is also contingent, as you just pointed out. And now you're asking the question, if something must exist, what are the things that must exist? Because that's the menu of things that we're choosing from. And we can even break this one down into things like concrete objects, that is to say, things that can cause things, and not concrete objects. And the word for not concrete is abstract.
And again, Scott, when you say concrete, you don't mean necessarily physical existence in space-time.
Right. Concrete simply means something that can cause things. Or maybe a better way of putting it is must exist and can cause things, or must exist and cannot cause things. So maybe that's better, is can cause, C-A-U-S-E, and it's not the case that they can cause. So what this leads you down, when you go down the, this is the side that I care about, and then this is the things that can cause things. Now the question is, what exists in this set of concrete objects that exist, that have to exist, that must exist, that can cause things? Now at that point, we are at the point where we've said we have to use our imagination, we have to use logic, and we have to lay out all the possibilities that we can even think of. And when we lay that out, we recognize that if they're concrete, and there's probably one other thing you can add to this one, is we're not there yet. This thing that we're talking about, this concrete thing that can cause things, actually even before can cause, you can say a necessarily existing thing. That thing, what are all the possible things that we've come up with over several thousand years or however long we've got? And the answer are there's only one thing in this set, and that thing is God.
President, before you get there, could you lay out in the must box, like some examples? I mean, we mentioned some earlier, but what could be up in the must box? God, love, numbers.
Necessary truths, truths that would have to be the case in any case, truths by definition. Married men are not bachelors.
So then logically we have to take that group of stuff, if you've written it out, we have to take those and stick them in one of the two
boxes,
concrete or not concrete boxes.
Right. And when you do that, this box is full of numbers and propositions and truths and things. This one you've only got one. So now to Dennis's point. So on Dennis's side here, maybe if I was going to make Dennis's point vis-a-vis this stuff, it's, well, you guys are saying that it is either God or one of these other things. What if it's something we haven't thought of yet? Okay, that might be the case. But this stuff right here shows you that it, whatever that is that we haven't thought of, must be necessary and it must be concrete. And I would challenge you to come up with anything that even possibly exists that's both necessary and concrete and ultimately can cause things. And that thing isn't something like a God, like God. It, any way that you end up drawing it, it's going to have God-like qualities. So you might as well call it God. There was a somebody tried to do a reducto ad absurdum to a Christian apologist one day. This one's on the record. You can see it. I can forward it out there. But basically, he wants to make the point. He wants to make this point. It's not God that is this thing. And so he says, this is William Lane Craig. He says, this thing has to be God. And this other guy says, no, I think it's a computer. And the guys, and William Craig says, computers are designed. And he goes, no, this is a self-designing computer. This one exists completely necessarily. And he's like, okay. He goes, well, computers have to operate over time. And the guy's like, oh, no, this is a wonderful, amazing, mysterious computer. It doesn't have to operate over time. It just is. And it knows, and, well, computers have to be programmed with stuff. They have limited memory and knowledge. Well, not this one. Oh, no, this computer's amazing. And then what Craig says back to him is, well, what you're calling a computer is, in fact, God. It has all the properties that we ascribe to God, and you've just used the label computer on it. That doesn't, you can call it whatever you want. But the reality is that the definition, semantics, means something. And the semantics here are, what's the definition of the word you're using? And if a computer is defined as all those things that Craig was saying, and God is defined as this thing, just switching the names doesn't win the argument for you. You have to talk about what the concept of the being really is.
The only unanswered question of mankind is God. You can't answer it.
Maybe ultimately.
No human can answer it.
I want to know why bacon is so good.
Yeah, I think there's probably other kind of answerable questions because of our limited intelligence. But I wanted to go back to, because you don't believe ideas are real, or exist, I should say, you don't believe they exist.
Right? I don't believe they exist necessarily, yeah.
Okay, so
I mean, like, if you have an idea in your head, I think that idea exists. I just don't think that that idea existed before you had it, unless somebody else had it.
My mind exists, and the neural pathways and the chemicals and all that stuff make it exist, so therefore you still don't think that...
I wouldn't agree with that. I think your mind exists independent of your brain, just because of what I happen to believe. But yeah, I get your point. So to your point.
Okay. So this is why you didn't get. This is why you think nothingness is easy.
Yeah.
Okay. So the scientists who argue that nothingness is more than what you're saying would say that the ideas are sort of like a framework that hold the universe together, but they're there without the universe.
Yeah.
Right. And so they say, well, that's laws. Those laws exist where the universe is there. Some people say, well, it's a different place those ideas come from. Okay, well, where's the sum of the parts? But if you think of them as a sort of a framework that holds the universe together, like the rules, they exist as a skeleton. Well, then they say, well, okay. Then you don't need God, right? Because, these math exists without the people or the universe.
Yep.
That's why I said the intentionality is important, because even if you get their argument, which is basically your cause plus God being a being or a concrete thing, if in their idea that ideas exist and they're this framework, they don't, you know, nothing, without a cause, there is no, and with nothingness, there is no cause, right? And so...
So the intentionality is...
That's why, yeah.
Sitting on the fence. We don't
so if you believe nothingness is the absence of everything, or you believe nothingness is the absence of the universe, if you will, other than the skeleton, you know, but...
So you're in good company in what the argument you're making there, because Stephen Hawking says the same thing. Stephen Hawking will tell you, he's written that the reason that we have that the universe exists is because the laws of nature make it so. The universe sprang forth because the laws of nature caused that to be the case. The problem with Hawking is, while he's a brilliant physicist and mathematician, he's not a particularly good philosopher, because all you do is run this tree on the good professor, and you say, are you saying that these laws of nature must exist? And he says yes. And we say, okay, are they concrete or are they abstract? And he says the laws themselves, which we think are abstract, are in fact concrete. They are causal in power. And you say to him, what other laws are causal? Are other ideas causal? Why are the laws of nature, which seem to be abstract laws, now all of a sudden causal? Why is it not the case that the idea of an apple causes things, as Daniel Dennett has once said? And the bottom line is, if an abstract idea actually turns out that it can be causal, then it's no longer abstract, it's concrete. And now you need an explanation of why the laws of nature are causal, but the laws of logic are not. Or the ideas that you have in your head are not causal, because those seem to be abstract as well. Why are they not causal? So there has to be an explanation of why this is, why these apparently causally effete things are causal. So, Carl, do you and Dennis want to open up the explanation so we know what you guys are into? Because we finished this point. This sounds like a really good discussion.
I'll let Dennis speak to it.
My argument really is not with philosophy. It can be, because I know nothing about it. My argument is with religion. And it all seems...
I think your argument's with...
Well, let him finish the point.
Let's hear his point.
Sorry, Dennis. Go ahead.
It always seems like, not philosophy, but it always seems like God is the explanation for everything. Now, since the Bible was written, whenever it was written, or since the Garden of Eden or whatever, science has progressively shown how things have been caused, explained, whatever word you want to use. It has shot down just about everything religion has said was gospel. No pun intended.
Yeah.
So why can't that progression keep going? Why is it going to stop when it comes to the origin of the universe?
The question is this: do you believe that there's anything that is true that is not accessible to science?
Say that again.
Do you believe that there's anything that is true that is not scientific? Is there anything that is true? Is there such a thing as truth that is not a scientific truth?
Well, I think science can explain just about everything.
Okay, I'm asking, is there anything that it can't explain?
Sorry.
So you said it can explain just about everything. You know, here's everything. Here's the bar of everything. And let's say science, once you were perfect at science, it can explain all the way up to here. Is there anything that exists in this block that science cannot and can never explain?
There are lots of things that science cannot explain now, but I've never used the word never explain.
Okay. So can you give me an example of something of... if I understand you properly, there is nothing that science will never be able to explain. Everything that there is eventually can be explained scientifically.
So far, that has been the case, but there are still a lot of things science can explain. I'll give you one
example. Sure.
Give you one example. Everybody's head in here is going to explode. But Darwin was right. Evolution is a fact. It's almost a fact. the origin of life is not a fact yet.
Okay.
And you and I have argued about this ad infinitum, but it's getting close to discovery. Now, what's going to happen to religion if science can prove as a fact, just like evolution is a fact, how life started on this earth?
I'll grant that. Let's say that last universal common ancestor, abiogenetic genesis to life, all that. Let's say all that's true. Is there nothing that you don't think science can never explain? I'll give you some examples of stuff that I might be thinking of. How about this? This is a beautiful work of art. Or we shouldn't kill Jews. 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 And I'm not writing clearly, am I? Or how about this one? Oops, sorry. Science is the correct method for knowing truth. How about that? Are any of these right here something science can ever explain? Or do they lie outside of science?
Again, the first one, I can't read it.
This is a beautiful work of art. We shouldn't kill Jews because they're Jews. Science is the correct method for obtaining truth or for knowing truth.
I think there's a lot of grounds for saying that science can do the last two. The first one is a subjective thing.
Okay, it's an aesthetic judgment. Let's go to this one then, because I'm interested in this. Tell me how do you use the scientific method to establish that truth?
Evolution.
I don't understand you. Can you explain more?
Human beings are social animals. They evolved as social animals.
Okay.
To just go around killing off whole segments of the population.
Oh, sorry, I don't mean that one. Do you think science is the correct method for knowing truth? Forget we shouldn't kill Jews. I'm talking about this one. Science is the correct method for knowing truth.
Yeah.
How do you explain that? How do you test that scientifically? How do you come to know that scientifically?
Because it's worked so far.
Okay, so this is true because it works so far.
So empirically.
Because it works so far. How do we know that what it shows is true? So we have these sets of beliefs, evolution. Science has told us evolution is true, or to say that that's what science says. How do we know that that's actually true? Because it works so far, it's good, it's predictive, it helps us make predictions. Okay?
Because there's a lot of empirical proof to show it is true.
Okay, so an empirical proof, okay? So what is the test that you design for this statement?
What does that one say?
Science is the correct method for knowing truth.
There's a scientific method.
Yep.
Has so far been shown to be extremely good and work.
Okay.
Not definitively.
You would have to find other methods.
Yeah. So are there no other methods that might work? Are there any other methods that help us learn truth?
Truths about... truths about works of art. Say.
Forget works of art. Let's talk about math. Have we used the science? Do you think that there are mathematical truths? Is it true that 3 plus 4 equals 7? Is it true that 30 divided by 3 is 10? Do you believe those are true?
Let me put it this way. We used to think that, Chris, I said this before, according to geometry, all angles add up to 180 degrees.
In a non-Euclidean surface.
That's not what they said at first. Because nobody knew there was such a thing as non-Euclidean geometry. Well, there may be such a thing as some math. Einstein's relativity depended on, concept of...
Yeah, it did.
Minkowski.
And he had it corrected.
Yeah.
He didn't have...
But go ahead. Minkowski in space-time and Einstein in space-time are different. Let's back up one second. Oh, we're way over time if I'd actually Tim stopped, realized where I was, we would have quit a long time ago. Let me say this. In the seeking of truth, in our desire to find out what's true, is it probable that we will solve all the problems of philosophy in this class, and we just need to be like, wow, we'll take the recording of this and send it all over the world, and everybody's going to agree with us, right? That's not going to be the case. So to us, and I'll recognize Dennis's contributions to this in a second, but I'll exclude you for the second to the Christians in the group. I'll say this. We cannot do what we do in love. Our orders from God, as we understand them, are not be the cleverest fellow and lady in the room. Our orders are not, our orders are to seek truth. But it's to seek truth in love. And if we fail to seek truth in love, we are not obeying the orders. And it's better to be loving and scientifically wrong, in my opinion, than it is to be scientifically and logically right and unloving. One can be a Christian and not do right, and one cannot be a Christian and do right. The bottom line, I think the important lesson there is, right is a real thing, and I appreciate it when we all do it. Yes, Dennis, last comment, and then I'm sorry, I apologize, we've gone way over time.
I didn't realize that human beings are just one more step on the scale of whatever evolution produces. Our brains cannot possibly comprehend absolute truths about philosophy, about logic, about science. We're just trying. But I don't think our brains are capable of understanding whatever the absolute truth is. I don't think we'll ever get there. But it's the trying to get there that's fun.
Now, I think you'll be pleased to know that many people in the room have said exactly the same thing that you've said.
Yeah. But you think that God is the absolute truth.
Yes. Because we're out of time, what I'll say is we'll pick this up next time there. We'll pick up the math point, and we'll pick up your point because they're excellent points and we don't want to lose them. So thank you for your patience and all of your help.